The first being Bailey and Peterson versus various individuals in the Parks and Wildlife Department.
Yes, Your Honor. Jennifer Riggs here for appellant Peterson and appellant Bailey.
All right, very good. And for appellee?
Thank you, Your Honor. Jason LaFon for appellees. With me at council table is Ralph Duggan, chairman of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission.
All right, very good. Thank you both. Our second case, Department of Family and Protective Services versus Grassroots Leadership, Valenzuela, and some individuals.
Christopher Munson from the Solicitor General's Office and Todd Fisher from the Attorney General's Office for the appellants.
All right, thank you, Mr. Munson.
Amy Warr for the appellees.
All right, thank you, Ms. Warr. If you want to go ahead and take the podium, Ms. Riggs. And for those of you in the audience, if you would please take a moment and silence any electronic devices that you might have, we would certainly appreciate that. Please feel free to come and go through the course of the arguments. And 15 and 5 division,
yes, sir,
on your time. All right.
And thank you, Justices Borland, Burrier, Goodwin. Thanks for the opportunity. This case is basically about property rights in deer that deer breeders were told by the regulators belonged to them, deer that were taxed, deer that were subject to seizure by sheriffs to satisfy unpaid judgments, deer subject to division as community property in divorce proceedings, deer the common law said belonged to deer breeders once they were in their possession, deer the statute, Parks and Wildlife Code, Chapter 43, said they could buy and sell attributes of ownership. But somewhere along the way, once upon a time, Parks and Wildlife said, yeah, you're right, you have a property interest. And like all property, it's regulated. We've never argued that deer are not subject to regulation. It's simply that somewhere along the way, Parks and Wildlife threw a monkey wrench in the process and said, oh, no, you don't own those deer. We own those deer. Those deer remain game. They remain wild animals. They remain our property, not your property. Why is it significant? Obviously, because if you have a property interest, it defines whether you have due process interest. And here, what Parks and Wildlife did was say, you can't do anything with your property because we have presumed them to all be unhealthy, and we're not going to give you notice in a hearing. And so what brought my clients to court in the first instance was, wait a minute, you've now put in question our ownership of the deer. Can we still buy them and sell them? Leave aside for a moment the issue of the chronic wasting disease rule, which we initially challenged and said was in excess of their authority and unreasonable. Look at what they actually did. Did they give us the hearing we believe we're entitled to under Chapter 43 before they declared Mr. Bailey's deer to be unhealthy, Mr. Peterson's deer to be unhealthy, and said you are no longer movement qualified, you cannot sell your deer, you cannot buy, you can't move your deer, you can't even release them out of the breeding pens because we've presumed that they are all unhealthy until you jump through all these hoops and comply with these rules. And no, we're not going to give you a hearing on those individual facts. Now, we believe that the individual facts about CWD, who'd you deal with, where'd the deer come from, has your herd been reconciled, we believe that individual facts will control whether they were reasonable in saying the deer were healthy or not healthy. We think that entitles our clients to notice in a hearing, a full-blown evidentiary hearing, perhaps not, but some kind of hearing because they are property. And when the state changes its position 180 degrees and says this isn't property anymore, we believe the courts have the jurisdiction to rule on our constitutional claim about the scope of our property interest and whether we're entitled to due process, and if so, how much, and whether they acted in excess of their authority by not giving us notice in a hearing. Now, what they have said for the first time in their brief is that, no, your possession of the deer is a bailment. It's you just possess them on behalf of the state. Well, that was not part of their motion for summary judgment, but it does raise a slew of questions. If it truly is a bailment, that's a contract, why wouldn't we have jurisdiction to challenge that? If the purpose for the bailment goes away, can't we just say, okay, state, come pick up your deer? I can tell you Mr. Bailey is about ready to retire, and he would absolutely love to have the state come pick up his deer. You pay for the cost of feeding them if they're your property. You take them. I don't want the headache anymore. But we never had the opportunity to litigate that because, of course, the trial court said there's no jurisdiction. Now, we think if they're right, if it is a bailment only and there's no property interest, a bailment's a contract, and we have due process interests in our contract, and we have the right to come back and say, oh, wait, is this contract supported by consideration or not? If it's an invalid contract and it really is a bailment, then we want to know whether we have the right to tell the state, come get your deer.
Counsel,
we don't want to play anymore.
Could you speak to the issue of whether the deck action is redundant of Mr. Peterson's APA claim?
Absolutely. The APA claim started as a challenge to the CWD rules. And the CWD rules just tell you, if you want to become movement qualified, here's the level of testing you have to go through. Now, originally, they did it as an emergency rule signed only by the executive director, and we challenged the emergency basis for the rule. They came back and fixed that. Then we challenged that the rule is overbroad, and there is an area of overlap, and the area of overlap is there's nowhere in the rule that we get notice in a hearing. But our challenge about the notice in a hearing is really based on Chapter 43, because the rule, if we're correct in the rule, if we were correct in our challenge under the APA rule challenge, it wouldn't resolve the issue of do we get a hearing, because the rule is silent. It doesn't say you get a hearing, you don't get a hearing. It simply says here's the testing you have to do. And we challenge the scientific basis for the testing, for the level of testing that was required. And we challenge the presumption that the rule created. But we don't think they're coextensive. This is somewhat like the Hager decision, which I understand briefing is due today in the Supreme Court. When we filed our brief, we noted it as a pet filed case, and since that time, the Hager versus Otto House, the Supreme Court has granted the petition and has asked for briefing. So I don't know what issues caught their attention. I don't know if they're going to help the court and litigants across the state, but we can only hope that they provide some guidance. There was a mootness issue in that case, and there was an issue of redundant remedies and the UDJA with an APA claim. And this court, I believe, in that case had said, no, they are coextensive, and had overturned the trial court and said there is no jurisdiction. So we may get a different answer, we may not. But I do think the Hager case is different in that we are challenging that we have a right under the statute to a hearing, and we are challenging that there were no findings. There are things that the rule challenge simply did not address. We're also here because of the jurisdictional challenge. I think everyone in this room probably rests secure in the belief that if the government regulators tried to regulate their property, be it their cars, their cell phones, their guns, their livestock, that they'd be entitled to come to court and say, hey, you took my property, or you said I couldn't use my property. When you say I can't use it, that's the equivalent, something like taking it, and you would believe that you have the right of redress coming to court. But let's assume for the sake of argument that there's no property right, and therefore no right to due process, and that the trial court was correct in dismissing the case for lack of jurisdiction. If that's the case, then why did the trial court, the only remedy we believe that is applicable in that case would be to dismiss, not to grant attorney's fees, not to rule conditionally in favor of Parks and Wildlife on the UDJA claim. You can't have it both ways, just like litigants in the private sector have been told for years, you can't have it both ways. It's you're going to have to elect your remedy. And more than that, it violates Article 2, Section 1 as an advisory opinion. Now, I'm frustrated by 54.0142. I mean, I have to build in delay. I have to tell my clients there's going to be almost always an appeal. And in defense of the Attorney General's office, if they have some basis for raising a plea to the jurisdiction, wouldn't they be disserving their client if they didn't pursue it and if they didn't pursue an appeal? But the purpose of 54.014 is not to give a sneak preview on the merits. It's to rule on pleas to the jurisdiction. Now, this is not an interlocutory. This is an appeal on the merits. But it goes to the heart of the fact that when the state files a plea to the jurisdiction, there's no statute that gives them the right to attorney's fees. There's no statute that governs and gives the trial court the ability to issue an advisory opinion. And most important, if there is no jurisdiction, then there's no jurisdiction to award attorney's fees. And
so no jurisdiction to give them at all, not the segregation issue, or are you arguing that separately?
Well, I think if this court decides that they do have, even if this court says, I think there was jurisdiction, Ms. Riggs, you're right, there was jurisdiction, but they got it right on that conditional, and we're going to rely on our authority to issue the decision the trial court should have rendered. So we think the trial court should have said there's jurisdiction, but we still think Parks and Wildlife wins. And then the court has to look at the issue of attorney's fees. And I think there, the Supreme Court's handed down a handful of cases that say you got to segregate your attorney's fees. And I think you review the record and you see the vast majority of their fees were devoted, despite the lack of specificity, which would help us in that regard, the vast majority of their fees were devoted to defending the CWD rule. And so we are challenging that it does not meet the Supreme Court standard with specificity and that it would be unjust to award the fees that have been assessed. Plus, there's another sub-issue, and that is that Mr. Bailey's wife was ill and he non-suited his claims. An affirmative claim can survive a non-suit. A claim for sanctions can survive a non-suit, but that's not what we have here. What we have here is a defensive claim, and we do not believe a defensive claim can survive the non-suit. So as to Mr. Bailey, even if the court says there was jurisdiction, Parks and Wildlife got it right, the trial court had lost jurisdiction as to Appellant Bailey.
So part of this is just the mishmash procedure of central docket. Y'all had the plea set, you had summary judgment set on behalf of your clients, countered by the state with theirs. Court takes it all up and does this conditional thing sort of in an effort, I guess, to save a step.
Well,
let me ask you this, going particularly to the, well, this gets to immunity, but this issue of what is the counterclaim that the state asserted and where? Is it only in their summary judgment motion?
I think in their summary judgment motion, they are asking for in the language of the motion for summary judgment, they're asking for a declaration that they own the deer. Now, they've come back and said, no, ours is purely defensive. Well, that gets us to that conflict amongst the courts of appeals, whether you can
do a mirror image deck action.
Correct. And we do have a conflict. There are courts that say, well, you can get attorney's fees for purely defensive, but you can't even file a mirror image deck action. Those haven't been reconciled. We're leaving that on your doorstep.
Thanks. The counterclaim, though, isn't in their pleadings. Is that right, in their answer?
I think
it's in their motion.
It's in their motion, and they're in some discovery responses. They have said, trial court, you do not have jurisdiction to issue a UDJA, but if you do, we get attorney's fees for defending it. It's in that language that they're relying on. Now, I think their motion goes beyond that and looks a little bit more like a true counterclaim, but they have come back and said, no, it was purely defensive. And I'm willing to take them at face value that they intended it to be purely defensive. Well, I will reserve what time I have left for rebuttal and any additional questions the court may have thought of after listening to opposing counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. If I may, I'll begin with correcting a couple of factual misstatements that were made by my colleague. She says that we didn't raise the bailment issue below. We didn't raise this argument. If you look to CR 1260, we argue in our summary judgment motion, quote, deer breeders possess deer in bailment. They do not own the deer. Texas Supreme Court has identified the elements that create a bailment. We go through that argument. It's simply not true that we didn't raise it below. They did not respond with this new argument, whatever this contract argument is that they make. They didn't respond with that below. That argument is forfeited. They didn't make it in their briefs. They made it for the first time here
I'd never heard it before, and so I can't really respond to it here except to say that it's forfeited. Second, council talks about Parks and Wildlife throwing a wrench into the ownership question. This court need only look to what the legislature did to answer the ownership question. The legislature said wild animals are property of the people of the state of Texas.
Well, can we ask a question right there? If these breeder bucks are in cages, and I'm sure you guys know as well as I do, they don't sell for tens of dollars. They sell for tens of thousands, if not $100,000. And so when they're bought and moved from there to here and put in their breeder cages and maintained behind extremely expensive high fences, which blanket this state, are those wild animals?
They are, Your Honor. The statute defines wild animals in terms that encompass deer. And the statute explicitly says, this is section 1013, that confining wild animals does not change their status. Now, what the statutes also say.
Are we going in a circle there?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the whole point here is that deer remain property of the people of the state of Texas throughout this process. Now, what the legislation also does is it gives deer breeders, people who have a deer breeder permit, the right to lawfully possess deer for the purpose of breeding and propagation. And so they have a right of lawful possession that they can assert that against third parties. They can't assert that against the state because the state still owns it. And so what they are allowed to do is they are allowed to possess deer, they are allowed to propagate deer, and they are allowed to sell those deer to other people who also have the right to possess and propagate deer. And they can establish a market within that. But on top of all of that is still the people of the state of Texas owning those deer. The people of the state of Texas allow the deer breeders to possess the deer and make money off of that, but that does not give the deer breeders a right against the people of the state of Texas, and that was the design that the legislature intended with the whole code put together. If I could then turn to the counterclaim point, the back and forth between Your Honor and my colleague established the point. I think there simply was no counterclaim here. You don't need a counterclaim under the UDJA to get fees. It says in any action under the UDJA, a party can get fees. It doesn't say that a plaintiff can get fees. So there was no need for the state to bring a UDJA action. All the state had to do was plead in its responsive pleading that it was seeking fees and cite the UDJA. That's
so
what it did.
So you don't need to worry about the confines of 12105 at all?
No. No, Your Honor. And what this also gets to is the non-suit question. This court, and I think every other court that has addressed the question, has held that a specific request for fees in responsive pleading that cites a statute, it satisfies Rule 162 as something that survives a non-suit, which makes perfect sense. You can't make the party go through the expense and then non-suit at the end of the day and avoid fees. That's what this court has held, and that's what every other court has held. And my colleague here is unable in her briefing to cite a single case in which a non-suit in this situation has allowed someone to escape fees.
How do we get from the finding of no jurisdiction to the awarding of attorney's fees?
Well, Your Honor, as my colleague here points out on page 48 of her brief, it is established precedent in this court that lack of jurisdiction over a UDJA claim does not bar fees, because what the statute says is that any proceeding that is brought under the UDJA, it was plaintiff's choice to bring this proceeding under the UDJA, and they then open themselves up to fees. And so the binding precedent of this court defeats plaintiff's argument.
So every time a plaintiff brings in a UDJA action and the state has to defend themselves and say, no, there's no jurisdiction, y'all can get attorney's fees?
Your Honor, we can ask for attorney's fees. It still remains under the wide discretion of the district court whether or not to grant us fees. And so this may be, under this court's precedent and under to be honest with Your Honor, every other court that has considered this question, a winning on a plea to jurisdiction does not bar fees, but what the plaintiff can argue is that it's not equitable or just to award fees in certain situations. That would be a tough road to hoe in this case when they made the state litigate for 2 years and spend millions of dollars litigating this case, including $500,000 dealing with discovery requests, only for the state to then win on jurisdictional grounds.
In your view, can the trial judge do it with the same pen that he signed finding no jurisdiction go on to award $400K or whatever? I know you guys think that's a moderate amount, but finding no jurisdiction go on to do it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't that need to be necessarily either a separate proceeding or that goes away if there's no jurisdiction?
Well, because the plenary power that the court retains just from having the proceeding allows it to award fees. And while it may not have jurisdiction to issue a declaration, it is a different question as to whether or not it has jurisdiction to grant fees.
Reconcile with me the law pertaining to the principles pertaining to an absence of subject matter jurisdiction on the part of a court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet an ability to award relief as against a party to the action.
Sure, Your Honor. Jurisdiction goes to power. So it is what does the court have the power to do?
And so don't we know in the law of jurisdiction, if a court has no subject matter jurisdiction, that is the end of the hunt?
No, Your Honor.
Can you give me a corollary where a court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, no authority over the subject before it, but yet has the ability to advance on beyond that and award relief?
Yes, Your Honor. A motion for sanctions, for example. If somebody brings a baseless claim that there is no jurisdiction to consider their claim and it is totally frivolous, the court still has power to award fees against that.
I admit that might be a fundamentally different question. Can we think of another substantive matter where it all stems from the subject matter before the court?
Well, Your Honor, I have to disagree with you there.
Was this awarded as a sanction?
No, Your Honor, but I think it is identical. The court has the power, the same way that under Rule 13, the court has the power to award fees, the court has the power under the UDGA to award fees. That's what this court has held. That's what every court has held. So under this court's precedent, it's no longer a question whether or not the court had the power to do that. And I think that in numerous situations, the courts without jurisdiction for the underlying relief that plaintiff requests still have jurisdiction to grant fees, and that's what happened in this case. If I could kind of go back to the beginning here and talk about jurisdiction over plaintiff's claims. Plaintiffs have brought two UDJA claims, one seeking to establish their ownership over breeder deer, and one arguing that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Code writ large, as applied to them, is unconstitutional because it omits notice and a hearing before plaintiff's transfer of breeder deer may be restricted. Plaintiff's ownership claim is barred by sovereign immunity, and both of their claims are redundant of their APA claim. The ownership claim, this court and the Supreme Court have both made clear that the UDJA waives sovereign immunity only for claims challenging the validity of a statute. On its face, plaintiff's ownership claim does not challenge the validity of any statute. On appeal, plaintiffs now say that their claim arises somewhere in the Texas Constitution. But even if that were so, it would still not challenge the validity of any statute, and so would be barred by sovereign immunity. Plaintiff's ownership claim is also redundant of their APA claim. In their live petition, plaintiffs say, quote, that the CWD rules all build on each other and are expressly premised on the assumption that the state and not deer breeders own all whitetail and mule deer in Texas, and that for that reason, no individual notice or hearing is required. So within their APA claim is the ownership question. And as this court has held, it is things that are implicit and explicit in judgment on some other claim. If they can get that through some other claim, then their UDGA claim is redundant. That same thing applies to their due process statutory claim. And here, it's important to note that plaintiffs do not actually challenge the validity of any statute. What they say is there's something missing. But if there's something missing, then they can get that through their APA challenge. If they win on their APA claim and say that, well, these rules are invalid because they don't give us notice and a hearing, then what the district court can do is say, I'm sending this back to you. You can give them notice and a hearing, or you can leave the rules. You can just throw them away. So what plaintiffs can get through the APA claim is notice and a hearing, exactly what they're seeking through their UDJA statutory claim. And so for that reason, their UDJA statutory claim is also redundant of their APA claim. Go through my notes here and make sure that I'm not leaving anything here. I would like to address the, they have this point where they go back to where they say that there's a presumption that these deer are not healthy, and that's simply not true. What the Parks and Wildlife Commission was trying to do and achieved was increasing the confidence that they have that CWD is not being transferred all over the state of Texas. And the legislature gave them the power to condition transfer permits within their discretion, and they are using that here. There's no presumption that any deer is unhealthy. It's simply trying to establish a sufficient level of confidence, somewhat comparable to what they're able to achieve with wild deer, to make sure that the deer all over the state remain healthy. And if the court has no further questions, I will give back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. LaFond.
Thank you.
Council indicates that the situation presented here is identical to that presented by Rule 13 and sanctions. That's not the case, because for a court to have continuing jurisdiction to issue sanctions, there must be a motion, an affirmative motion seeking sanctions pending. And I believe there, I have not briefed the issue in our briefing. I don't believe they did either. But I believe there is case law out there indicating that if you have not yet filed it before the end of the 30-day plenary period, then the trial court will not have jurisdiction. So there is an affirmative motion required. On the issue of the rule granting us all the relief required, what we're seeking is to basically enforce what we believe 43.3591 of the Parks and Wildlife Code confers. However, we did contend that to the extent that it does not confer the right to notice in a hearing, that code is unconstitutional. We disagree, however, that we have to file a facial challenge to a statute in order for the courts to have jurisdiction over constitutional claims. LEAPER involved a challenge to a letter regarding the truancy law. The McIntyre case involved the state coming in and wanting to review a homeschool family's curriculum. Those were not facial challenges, and yet the court said they involved constitutional claims, and you do not need a waiver of immunity if you are challenging that government officials have exceeded their authority and violated constitutional rights. So we disagree that a waiver of immunity is required for anything other than a facial challenge to a statute, which is what I thought I understood counsel to be saying. So our challenge does, however, center down on 43.3591 and 43.362. They have to be read in harmony. To an extent, going back to Justice Goodwin's question, if the court believes, to an extent, our challenge to the rule is that the rule's not in harmony with these statutory provisions because the rule presumes that the deer are unhealthy and imposes conditions and kind of skips a step and denies movement qualification. To that extent, there is overlap, but we believe our challenge that we're entitled to a determination of what is the nature of our right and whether we get notice in a hearing is distinct from the rule challenge. And the fact that a trial court could fashion a remedy, I would love to have trial courts fashion a remedy, but I think that what the APA says is that they can reverse or reverse and remand, and they may even send a rule back to an agency to reconsider it, but I don't think the trial court has quite the authority to tell the agency, go that far and tell the agency what remedy it has to promulgate. I wish they could, but I think that under the APA, the remedies are more limited, and that's why we brought our constitutional claims. And that's why we're asking the trial court to reverse what, or asking this court to reverse what the trial court has done, and I'll give the court back my remaining time, unless there are questions.
Thank you, Ms. Riggs. Thank you both for your presentation. The case will be submitted for consideration.
I know.